Thank you for joining us to learn more about best practices in pulse dye laser treatment. With us today is Dr. Navid Ezra, a dermatology resident at the Indiana University School of Medicine in Indianapolis. Dr. Ezra, what settings should be used when treating vascular lesions, and how can laser operators minimize the risk for adverse events?
Thank you for having me today for this CUTIS audiocast. The pulse dye laser, or PDL, is considered to be the laser of choice for the treatment of many cutaneous vascular lesions, especially port wine stains, superficial hemangiomas, poikiloderma of savate, and facial telangiectasias and rosacea. Rosacea was discussed in a previous audiocast from Dr. Gary Goldenberg at Mount Sinai. Also, hypertrophic and keloidal scars, psoriasis, and warts are amenable to the treatment with pulse dye laser. While the initial pulse dye laser systems emitted the 577 nanometer yellow light, slightly longer wavelength pulse dye laser devices, the 585 and the 595, have been adopted to allow deeper tissue penetration of up to 1.5 millimeters. Some believe that this new wavelength, since it has a deeper tissue penetration, can also have a higher incidence of adverse effects. But back in 1995, Roy Geronimus and his colleagues looked at the incidence of adverse reactions associated with the use of the pulse dye laser in the treatment of vascular lesions. They studied 500 patients undergoing the pulse dye laser treatments for port wine stains, telangiectasias, and hemangiomas. And of those 500 patients, there were no cases of hypertrophic scarring. The incidence of atrophic scarring was less than 0.1%. And the risks of hyperpigmentation, hypopigmentation, and even a spongiotic dermatitis were all less than 3%. So this just goes to show you how safe the pulse dye laser can be in the treatment of vascular lesions. Now, patients frequently present to dermatology offices for management of facial telangiectasias, such as the case that we reported in this month's issue of Cutis. These telangiectasias are most commonly associated with rosacea and chronic photo damage, but it's also important to consider the setting of telangiectasias in liver disease, autoimmune connective tissue disorders, surgical scars, and even the misuse of topical corticosteroids. Facial telangiectasias are typically located on the nose, cheeks, and chins, and they rarely get larger than 1 millimeter in diameter. And so this caliber of telangiectasia is commonly treated with the pulse dye laser, but other devices that can be employed are the KTP laser and the IPL systems. When the pulse dye laser is used with short pulse durations, significant clearance can be achieved, but with significant bruising. The choice of appropriate pulse dye laser parameters affects the tissue response in terms of both efficacy and appearance. Short pulse durations, usually in the range of about 0.5 to 3 milliseconds, cause a purpuric reaction related to intravascular coagulation. While very effective for telangiectasias, the bruised appearance is not cosmetically acceptable to many patients. Clearance of facial vessels can also be achieved with non-purpuric fluences, ranging from 6.5 to 8.5 joules per centimeter squared, with longer pulse durations in the range of 10 to 16 milliseconds. These can be used with spot sizes of 10 to 12 millimeters as desired. Although slightly less effective, the longer pulse durations may be used with pulse stacking. Pulse stacking is the application of a rapid succession of pulses to a particular location with cooling to achieve treatments that are purpura-free. We often employ this in our clinics. It's quite effective and less noticeable as the patient leaves the office. Multiple treatment sessions may be required. These techniques can be particularly beneficial for patients with recurring flushing and central facial erythema. The latest generations of pulse dye laser devices modulate this approach, and they even divide each pulse into 8 micropulses, and this has many benefits. It's said to be more selective, it provides uniform vascular heating with a reduction in purpura, and it also tends to be more comfortable and well-tolerated by patients. The epidermal protection during laser treatments, including those with pulse dye laser, is critical. Cooling helps to reduce blistering, crusting, and subsequent dyspigmentation. The most common cooling strategies are contact cooling, forced cold air, and cryogen spray. In addition to protecting the epidermis from the non-selective thermal damage, the cooling also allows for the use of higher fluences with improved efficacy and reduced adverse effects. Providing informed consent and warning patients about the risk for adverse events prior to undergoing pulsed dye laser treatment is a must. Verbal and written postoperative instructions for patients undergoing laser therapy is extremely important, and controversy still exists regarding the role of non-physicians performing laser surgery and the increased risk of injury associated with this practice. Just a few months ago in April, Matthew Avram and his colleagues published a study in JAMA Dermatology looking at the incidence of medical professional liability claims stemming from cutaneous laser surgery performed by non-physician operators. They found that claims related to laser surgery on the skin by non-physician operators, particularly outside of a traditional medical setting, are increasing. Personally, I would advise physicians and other laser operators to be aware of their state laws, especially in regard to physician supervision of non-physician operators. In conclusion, laser engineers are very insightful, and they have provided us with an armamentarium of energy-based devices that can more precisely target the correct structures and induce the correct responses. We really should celebrate the enormous energy that goes into newer and more sophisticated devices, just as we should criticize and reject devices which underperform and overpromise. I'm very excited about advances just around the corner that will bring us more targeted, cost-effective, durable, and more tunable devices. New wavelengths are becoming available, targeting structures important in the control of acne and for body contouring. And as new devices emerge, it'll be important to consider safety and efficacy as a harmonic balance. Lastly, I'd like to just reiterate the main practice points for this article. Firstly, lasers should be used by experienced operators, and treatments should be tailored to individual patient needs. Secondly, multiple passes at subperforic settings with a pulsed dye laser may lead to safer results with fewer adverse events, and at the same time, more tolerable treatments for the patient by minimizing downtime associated with purpura. And lastly, although scarring is rare, it can occur and should be part of the patient's informed consent prior to treatment. I thank you again for your time and attention. Please feel free to email me with any questions or comments you may have.
Thank you, Dr. Azra, for your discussion of best practices in pulsed dye laser treatment. For more information, access Dr. Azra's article in the August 2014 issue of CUTIS here on CUTIS.com.